This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is supported by Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Now your host, Rick Moore.
And Happy New Year, everybody. Thank you so much for being with us here at WNRN. 2015. And you know what we're going to do today? We're going to talk about one of those resolutions that everybody discusses all the time. I got to save more money. I got to do something about my finances. And so we bring in the experts, one of the money professors. We have Assistant Professor of Business at Piedmont Virginia Community College, Bill Pratt. Good morning.
Good morning, Rick. Thanks for having me here.
Well, I always appreciate folks who take time on their Sundays to come down, especially when it's sort of still the holiday time. Today, when do you go back to teaching at Piedmont?
We start back tomorrow. Teaching actually starts another week from now, so we're good.
Right, so it's the last day of the holiday time period.
That's true.
And here you are with me. Thank you so much.
I love talking about money. What can I say?
Well, there you go. So we will be talking about money, personal finance, with Professor Bill Pratt, Assistant Professor of Business at PVCC, also Vice President of the Money Professors. We'll talk about that in a second. And author of two books, How to Keep Your Kid from Moving Back Home After College. I always chuckle when I read that. And second, The Graduate's Guide to Life and Money. I'm sure we will discuss those as well. So, Professor, the Money Professors, a bit about that.
Sure. Yeah, when I was teaching at East Carolina University, I met two colleagues that were also very passionate about personal finance. And the three of us just started doing personal finance presentations and writing books and textbooks together and formed a group called the Money Professors, where we, you know, go to different colleges and different events and actually speak about topics on personal finance, both to adult learners as well as college students.
And so here you are teaching, speaking on the radio, writing books. Can people still find those books if they go in and Google Pratt, Bill Pratt? They can find your books on Amazon or somewhere nearby for the local good local bookstore?
Yeah, the easiest way to do it would just be going to Amazon.com. We went that route. It's much easier than trying to get into all the individual bookstores and so forth.
All right, so let's jump right into it. Personal finance, New Year's resolutions, and, of course, new laws, at least federal laws. Are there any new federal laws that would affect the way people might think about their finances for 2015?
There's not a lot of significant laws. The usual things change. You have a slight cost of living adjustment with taxes, which is helpful, obviously. And then some maximum contributions for 401ks goes up just a little bit. And then, of course, you have the health care law. And, you know, the best advice for the health care law is cross your fingers, hope it doesn't affect you much, and hire a professional.
And next week we'll be talking about that, the Affordable Care Act. Carolyn Engelhard, professor from University of Virginia, will be here. She'll be talking about Obamacare, as it's often referred to. But for the New Year's resolution, you know, when you talk about personal finance, there's budgeting, there's savings, there's expenditures. Give me two key steps.
Sure. The first step is to set goals. That's sort of what a New Year's resolution is, really. I mean, we call them a New Year's resolution, but it's really just a goal. You know, the goal might be to lose weight. The goal might be to save more money, to pay off some debt, whatever the case might be. Obviously, in our case, we're talking about the financial goals. So setting that goal or multiple goals is actually the first big key, the first big step. And then the second thing is to get organized. You have to get everything organized at the beginning of the year. So, for example, if your goal is to, you know, put your kid through college for the first year without them borrowing, you have to start by putting your taxes together. Once you put your taxes together, you have to put together the federal FAFSA form. And, you know, those are some things that you want to be taking care of this time of year. I know, for example, University of Virginia, they just had their, whatever they call it, early decision. And now we're getting into the regular decision. A lot of schools have the same type of deadline. So those are some of those key things you want to get done at the beginning of the year. If your goal is to save money, for example, you need to be looking at things such as your car insurance and your homeowner's insurance and other places you spend money. Well, you want to pull the declaration pages or the pages that say what your actual coverage is, your deductibles, things like that, because you don't want to comparison shop and find out you could save money by going to another insurer only to find out it's because they gave you less coverage or higher deductibles. So you want to be able to compare apples to apples. So definitely setting those goals and getting organized early is the key.
I don't know that I qualify as average or not, but reading those, the fine print on insurance information for me can be, makes my eyes weary and my brain a little dead. So how does somebody do that?
The first step is to try to find a trusted agent. And, you know, that the best way to do that, obviously, is to start talking to people you know who use people. Because if they had someone they got rid of, they'll tell you that. And if they have someone they have now and they really like them, they'll tell you that as well. And once you have a trusted agent, then you don't have to know quite as much about the fine print. But the keys are to understand how much coverage do you have and how much is it going to cost you if you have to file a claim. And those are really the two most important ingredients. Of course, then how much you have to pay each month as well.
We are talking with Professor Bill Pratt about personal finance. You can find his books, How to Keep Your Kid from Moving Back Home After College, as well as The Graduate's Guide to Life and Money, talking about personal finance. Here, you're, write down the phone number. We'll take calls in a little while if you have questions for the professor. 434-979-0919. This is 91.9 WNRN and Richmond's 103.1. Professor, you were on a year or so ago, and one of the key things that came away for me in our conversation was you spoke about approved versus afford, as well as pre-tax income versus post-tax expenditures, sort of, and talk about the difference. They seem sort of tied together. Talk about those
sure.
two things.
Yeah, they actually, they are tied together in a sense. What it has to do with the difference between the perception and reality is really what we're talking about. So when you go to a bank, you go to a car dealer, you know, anything where you're borrowing money, and they say you're approved for, you know, fill in the amount, say $25,000, that doesn't mean you can afford a vehicle or a loan for $25,000. Approved simply means the bank is willing to give you the money. They don't care what you have to sacrifice to pay it back. You might not be able to afford it because you might know, well, we're going to send our kid to soccer camp, or we're going to, you know, put in a swimming pool, or we're going to go on vacation this year. The bank's assuming you're willing to give all that up, because if it's what you can afford, I'm sorry, if it's what you're approved for, that means it's the maximum amount they're willing to give you before they start having heartburn. And so don't fall for that perception of what you could borrow. You need the reality, which is what you can actually afford. And only you know what you can afford because you have to look at what your other expenses are and say, well, here's my other priorities in life. And if my priority is a nice vacation, then maybe I can only afford, say, $20,000 for the car instead of $25,000.
Is there a sort of a rough percentage if you go online and look, because when buying a house anyway, you can go online now and punch in the numbers to some website, and it'll say, you know, give us this information, what's your income, you know, and if it gives me the information back saying that I can get a loan for $300,000, should I use a rough estimate and cut that by 80%? Or, you know, so can you help me with the afford versus approved?
Sure. One of the easiest ways to do that, if you want a rule of thumb, is use what I call the 20% rule. And that is you need to be able to put aside 20% of whatever your payment is. If you can't afford the additional 20%, you cannot afford that payment. So think about a car, for example. If your payment on your car is $400 a month, you should be able to put aside an additional 80, because that way 20% is always sitting there. And then when you do have a problem, when you do have an emergency or a replacement need, you have the money. Even if it's something as simple as a $1,000 refrigerator, you should be able to put aside $200 extra. If you cannot afford the extra 20%, then start lowering your payment down to where you can afford that 20%. Then that should be about within your affordable range.
And tie this in for me to the pre-tax income versus post-tax expenditures. We're talking about a paycheck here, correct?
Absolutely. So well, here's the problem. A lot of times we like to focus on the biggest number possible, and that's exciting. So say you make $50,000 a year, right? So it's easy to say, well, I make $50,000 a year, but you don't actually have $50,000 left over after taxes and other deductions. You have much, much less. And so we start focusing too much on the big number, which is a number that we don't even get to spend, and we should instead focus on what we actually get to bring home, because it's our bring home pay or our cash that we can actually use for spending.
But how does an adult, because I work with so many people who need to touch and feel, and I would assume that there are a hefty percentage of people out there as well who work best with real life rather than with numbers in the head. So how can someone learn this type of information so that they can apply it on a daily or you know, paycheck basis rather than listening to it via radio?
Well, I mean, there's several ways you can do it. Obviously, reading is the easiest thing to do. We have access to articles, you know, everywhere, even books everywhere as well. So certainly reading is one of the ways to do this. There's also classes, you know, you can always pick up a course. We do, for instance, PVCC offers a personal finance course at least every other semester, sometimes every semester as well. But there's all types of things online as well. The other thing to do is, if you're a hands-on type of person, is you could use what we've called the envelope system, where you actually take envelopes and you put cash in those envelopes. And for instance, you might put $200 in a gasoline envelope, or you know, $150 every month in your vacation envelope. And you can actually watch it grow. Plus, you can watch it shrink as you go to make expenses. So it's a little bit harder to say, let's just eat pizza, when you open up your envelope and you realize you're physically pulling money away from your, let's say, dining out envelope, and you might instead say, you know what, let's just cook what we have in the fridge. And that way you can see the money that you're saving. When it's coming on an electronic card, it's so easy to just keep spending it because you don't see the results of the expenditures.
There you go. I like that. That might help me a little bit. It's 11:12 here on the Wake Up Call, WNRN. Talking with Professor Bill Pratt about personal finance, a New Year's resolution, but something that was probably important on December 30th, as important as it is on January 4th, I think. Phone numbers, you're welcome to call up and ask a question about Professor Pratt, whether it's specific maybe to your family, an issue that you've had with, I don't know, are you a tax expert?
No, I would not consider myself a tax expert.
What?
But I could certainly refer you to people who are.
So call us up if you'd like. 434-979-0919. One of the things that we shared information about, sent me an email, talked about working towards financial security. And we'll bounce back and forth with this article throughout the hour. One of the things that I found important, especially, I guess, at the start of the year, allowed you to look back over 12 months previous to identify some of these issues, was seal the leaks.
Yeah, sealing the leaks. What we're talking about is, you know, just like in your home, you want to use weather stripping and so forth because there's spots where you know air is escaping from your house or cold air is getting in. The same thing with your personal budget or spending. Is that there's certain leaks out there, you know, maybe a gym membership that you still have that you never actually attend the gym, so you could cancel that membership, or maybe magazine subscriptions, and the only thing the magazines do is move from tabletop to tabletop, and no one ever reads them. So you have all kinds of subscriptions and memberships and so forth. It could be something as simple as your cable bill. Do you have, you know, an NFL package that's, you know, a couple hundred dollars a year you're not using, or, you know, HBO-type channels that you're not watching and so forth. So, you know, we have so many different options nowadays that we tend to maybe do a trial run, you know, the first month's free and so forth. But now we have Hulu and Netflix and all these other accounts kind of just sitting out there that we're paying for. And they're not big dollar amounts, but they do add up, and you can use them towards something more useful in your budget.
Right, and so many, not in any surprising way, of those things are built to the betterment of the company. It's here, get 3 months free, but you have to go through 4 steps to cancel the subscription.
Yeah, they don't like to make it easy for you to cancel a subscription. You know, interestingly enough, I one of the things I talk to students a lot about are, you know, the way marketing works. And one of the things I learned quickly was, you know, those packages that are really difficult to open up? You have to use like scissors and a chainsaw and a sawzall and, you know, 3 people and that sort of thing. And they do that on purpose because they found that the more difficult it is to put things back together, the less like you are to return it. And the same thing happens with canceling. The more difficult it is to cancel a subscription, the less likely you are to cancel it, particularly if it's a small dollar amount. So for $2.99 a month or $3.99 a month, it might not be worth the effort any particular month to spend the hour it takes to dig up the paperwork to cancel it.
And Bill Pratt here with us today, professor of business at PVCC. Hang tight.
Support for WNRN Today comes from Virginia Vinegar Works and the following underwriters.
Road Holland Cycling Apparel, maker of cycling jerseys and shorts. Road Holland's designs for men and women echo the classic cycling jerseys of the past, featuring American sizing. Road Holland, based in Richmond and selling to the world at roadholland.com.
Blue Moon Diner, 512 West Main Street in the heart of Midtown Charlottesville, serving breakfast, lunch, and dinner weekdays with brunch on Saturday and Sunday. Blue Moon has live music with Jim Wave every Wednesday and more music Thursday and Friday. The full calendar is on Facebook. Blue Moon Diner, feeding the community since 1979.
Music Today, creating jobs in Charlottesville and Crozet. Music Today powers official web stores for hundreds of artists, athletes, and entertainers. You can learn more at musictoday.com. That's Music Today, a delivery agent company.
This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN, brought to you by the Markets of Tiger Fuel. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And happy 2015, everybody. Thank you for being with us today, along with Professor Bill Pratt. He is the author of How to Keep Your Kid from Moving Back Home After College, as well as The Graduate's Guide to Life and Money. We had here's a question from a listener. How do you teach your kids the value of money, similar to how you talked about putting cash in the envelopes?
Yeah, I mean, dealing with kids, you know, it depends on the age, obviously, but from the time the kid is old enough to ask for something, they're old enough to start learning about money, because all money really is, you know, the basic economics, it's allocation of scarce resources, meaning they want lots of things and there's only so much money to go around. So you can start early and obviously start often. But the key really is to start letting them make decisions. So for example, you go to the store and maybe they have a bunch of little toys they want to get. And what you might do is say, okay, well, I'll tell you what, you will get $5. And so let's go through the store together and you decide what you want. And they'll pick out the first item, but then make sure you keep shopping with them because they'll find a second item. And then you say, well, now we either have to put the first item back or not. Because one of the things that most parents tell me is they've learned quickly is that students will spend, or I say students all the time, their kids will spend an unlimited amount of their money, but not of, you know, the parents' money, but not their own. So for example, oh, I really need that toy. Oh, okay, great. We'll use your allowance money. Well, I don't need it that bad, right? So that's really how you can start is letting them kind of see the money dwindle and start with small amounts like $5, you know. But as you get older, for example, what my parents did when I was in middle school even is they took me shopping and handed me cash. And it was the first time I had that much cash in my hand. And they said, this is your clothing budget. And suddenly I started realizing the purpose of going to TJ Maxx as opposed to going to the mall to buy my clothes.
Something I remember, I don't know whether I read this on the Money Professor's site or a previous conversation with you, that I think fell into that that post-tax expenditures column, but it seems like it would fit here as well, is the number of hours you had to work to get something. If you wanted to go out to dinner, it wasn't just $50. It was the 3 hours you had to work to afford to go out. And actually, if you thought about it, it was 4 hours, because it wasn't the 3 hours for the $17 an hour you make. It was the 4 hours for the post-tax, you know, after the government gets their cut. Is there a way to do that for allowance for your kids? Or should you even bother? Is that something that's too difficult or unimportant for the kids?
Well, first of all, let me go back to what you said. You brought up an excellent point, and that has to do with, you know, when you do spend money, and we talked about pre- and post-tax a few minutes ago, you're not spending pre-tax money, you're spending post-tax money. So if you make $20 an hour, but you only get $15 an hour after taxes, then something that's $60 is not 3 hours worth of work, it's 4 hours worth of work, because you can't spend the pre-tax money. You only get to spend the post-tax money. So always keep in mind how much more expensive things are in terms of time. And you could do that with kids, depending on their age. For example, you could say that we're going to give a student kid allowance, and 20% of that allowance has to go towards savings. And so all of a sudden, they now get that sort of, it's not really tax, but sort of that pre-post savings amount, certainly. But one of the things to be careful of is don't try to teach too many things at one time, because then you just confuse too many variables. So it's best to kind of pick one point and say, I'm going to teach this one point until the my kid understands this one point, then I'll move on to the next point. You know, if you think that's kind of how elementary schools work, you know, you learn when you hit middle school that the stuff they told you in elementary school was kind of, well, it's kind of broadly speaking correct, but now we're going to get into more details in middle school and so forth.
And I also want to remind people that for some of us, it's 6 hours to be able to afford to go out for that $50 meal or something similar. We're not just talking to people who make $20 an hour here. Professor Bill Pratt, Assistant Professor of Business at Piedmont Virginia Community College and Vice President of the Money Professor. So hopefully that we answer that question about how to
Rick,
help
I do have
kids.
To keep my math as simple as possible.
Yes, well,
I was going to do $100 an hour to make it easy.
But. And, you know, I do that all the time, and people go, well, that's not realistic. Yes, but I can move the decimal point so much more simply that way. You talk about setting a budget, or this article that we shared before over the weekend. Another way towards working towards financial security was to set a budget. And this comes to mind because we were just mentioned the word realistic.
Right.
So this article says that for housing, transportation, utilities, and groceries, when you add all those things up, they shouldn't take more than 50% of your take-home pay.
That's what it says. So,
is that realistic, do you think?
I mean, it can be. You know, it really depends on your income, because if you're making $30,000 a year, it's going to eat up a huge percentage of your budget. I mean, just throw in groceries. But if you're making $170,000 a year, then it doesn't have to. It might, because you'll probably have a more expensive house. But, you know, but then suddenly your grocery budget is going to be a much smaller percentage. So it really does depend on your income. And, you know, one of the problems with rules of thumb, and we try to use them to simplify people's lives, it's that they're not very personal. And since personal finance obviously is personal, it makes it difficult to do. I find that most advice for budgeting is very technical and very complex. It's boring, and it keeps people from doing it, so there's no success. What I like to do with budgeting is quite simple. My wife and I keep two accounts, not a his and her account, but we keep two accounts. One account is where all the bills come out of. So, you know, housing, the gas for the cars maybe, you know, you could put your cable bill, your insurance, everything that you know you have to spend, you put it in one account. Then you know you've never touched it by accident. You didn't accidentally go out to dinner and spend your mortgage money. Then in another account, usually it's much smaller, unfortunately, that's your spending money. so that what category you choose to spend it at that point, that's not really that significant. That's up to you. But if you overspend eating out one weekend, well, then you just don't have a lot of money to go to the movies for the next couple weeks. But that's okay, because you know that the things that you have to pay for are already in a separate account. And that's kind of budgeting as far as I'm concerned. It's just keeping your money in a separate place that is already accounted for.
But the money has to go into the accounts. So how do you determine how much money to put into each account?
Well, yeah, so initially you have to kind of create a list. And so to me, this budget is simply, what do I have to spend? So that would be, again, you know, what do you have every month? You have your, let's say, a car payment or a mortgage payment, taxes, if you pay those separately, you know, real estate taxes, personal property taxes. Now, some of these are not monthly expenses, and that's the hard part. I call those expected emergencies or what have you, where, you know there are certain things that are non-monthly that you need to put money away for. And once you create that list, you put all that money aside, and then, you know, you can set up your bank account to transfer and so forth. But then you're set. So yes, you're right. You do have to have that initial, when you get organized up front at the beginning of the year, you have to create that list of everything. But once you do, you can kind of set it and forget it, so to speak.
You have two acronyms that I found, and I believe I found them on the Money Professor website. What's that website?
Yeah, themoneyprofessors.com. It's plural.
Okay. And there's spend, S-P-E-N-D, and there's life, yep. L-I-F-E. Start with whichever one you'd like.
Sure. So one of the things we talk about, when I say we, I mean the money professors, if you will, my colleagues and myself. One of the things we talk about is that, you know, people sometimes put together loose financial plans, yet sometimes they seem to fail. And the key is why. And we say that's because life happens. And we use that acronym, life. The L is listed expenses are too small, meaning you said, well, I think my groceries are $100 a month, right? Which is fine if you're single and you don't eat, but, you know, really that's not big enough. The I is impulse purchases. How many times do we go in to get grocery, bread and milk, and we end up spending $75, right? Then you have fixed expenses are too high. And that's where maybe you went out and purchased a vehicle that was just too high. You bought a home that was a little too expensive. Maybe your credit card payments are a little too high. So you need to start adjusting your fixed expenses, the things you can't really control month to month. And then the E is emergencies, right? Because a lot of people don't plan for emergencies. I always find it interesting that even our federal government, you know, we know there's always going to be, unfortunately, at least one natural disaster a year, whether it's a tornado, an earthquake, and we're going to give a lot of money. And yet every year we act surprised and have to run around and try to find it. Why there's not an emergency fund, I don't have any idea. But in our personal life, we can do that. So life happens, and we have to get used to it. And what we say jokingly is the best way to prevent life from messing up your finances is to spend your way to financial security. And we use the acronym SPEND, S-P-E-N-D, save for emergencies, so that takes care of one of the problems. Plan your purchases, so don't just go in on a whim, you know, make a list and plan them out. Establish some financial goals. Because if you don't establish some goals initially, then you don't know what you're working towards. And then never let others spend your money for you. And that's not just your kids. That includes salespeople and so forth. I know that when I'm looking at a vehicle, everybody I know has an opinion on what options I should be adding to that vehicle. Well, remember, it's your vehicle. Don't let others spend your money for you, because they'll be happy to do that. And then finally, D, don't forget about non-monthly expenses. You know, we just had a major holiday season, and lots of people had to borrow money because they didn't realize that, for instance, Christmas is on December 25th, and it's every year. And then birthdays fall on the same time each year, anniversaries fall on the same time each year, and so forth. So those are non-monthly expenses, but let's not forget about those when we're setting money aside each month.
You talk about using or borrowing money for holidays. And I'm assuming when you talk about borrowing money, you mean putting it on the credit card.
Right, yeah.
When you see a lot of credit card advertising now, it's get cash back. Do you think as for a regular user of a credit card, and by that I mean someone whose bill isn't increasing on a monthly basis, but someone who makes credit card purchases and, you know, pays off regularly, is the cash back, getting your 1%, your 2% back, is that a worthwhile advertising thing to look at when determining which bank to use?
Well, for the advertisers, it's great. For us, for you and I, it's not significant. I mean, perks are helpful, sure. You know, it's, I guess, no different than using a coupon maybe, but, you know, 1% is not significant. Now, what I can tell you is you're not going to find Warren Buffett or, you know, Bill Gates or anyone like that going around going, whoa, you know, I never would have made it if it wasn't for that 1% back that I got in cash, right? So wealthy people understand that it's not that significant, but it is a perk. So if I'm going to have to make a decision between cash back and not cash back, then certainly you might as well get the 1%. But understand that's not going to make or break your financial security. That's just going to be a slight little bonus, you know, kind of like taking the change from your pocket and putting it in a jar. And at the end of the year, you'll have a couple hundred dollars, you know, to spend on vacation. So it's a, you know, an extra, you know, an extra little dinner out, you know, nice dinner out on vacation or something like that. So it helps, but it's not a make it or break it type of decision.
Our guest today, Professor Bill Pratt here from the Department of Business at PVCC. We're talking about credit cards. So many places, so many credit card companies are giving you your credit card number for free on your report, on your statement, monthly statement. Talk about the number versus the credit card report.
Sure. So what you're getting now, and this is actually a great benefit in my opinion, because it used to be you'd have to pay for a credit score. Now they're making it so that you can actually get your actual FICO score. It's called a FICO score because Fair Isaac Company is sort of the main driver behind the score. So there's all kinds of scores out there that you can pay for, but the only one that really matters, the one that's closest to what the actual bank is going to look at or the mortgage company, would be your FICO score. And so you're actually getting your FICO score now on, like, Discover Card is one of them. I don't remember some of the other ones. So it's actually a great benefit because it gives you an idea now of what other people are looking at in terms of lenders and so forth. Now, what the score is for is it's what I always call, it's like a letter grade for your class. You know, it says, oh, you know, Bill has an A or a B. And so people know whether you're a good risk or not to lend you money. What it doesn't tell you is what's on your report. So let's say you have a good score of, say, 750, right? That's a great score. So you have a 750, you say, that's great. Now you're happy. But you don't know why you have a 750 necessarily. So if you look at your report, what the report does is that's kind of your history. It says, oh, well, here's what your account balances are. Here's how much you owe. Same thing, I guess. How much you have available credit and how much you owe. It tells you, tells everyone who looks at the report, you know, do you have a good credit history? Are you making your payments on time and so forth? So there's a lot of information on the report, and the report is something you can get for free. That you can go to annualcreditreport.com, and that's a website that the federal government makes the three major credit bureaus give you access to. So you can go and look at each report once a year, or all three reports one time, whatever, and actually see what's on your report.
Well, why did the company start giving that number for free?
That was a relationship they worked out with the credit card companies. You know, credit card companies are always looking to give you benefits because they make a lot of money off of us, frankly. And so the more they can give us little benefits to try to say, well, come over here because we have these bells and whistles, then that's some sort of added benefit for you. And then one of the things they also want to do is say, look, here's your credit score. And only 20% of us are in the highest credit score, so that leaves 80% of us. And they can say to us, well, gee, now you know your credit score. We're giving it to you every month. It's right in front of your face. Wouldn't you like to hire our credit monitoring service now or our credit repair services and so forth? So a lot of times they're just going to try to use that score to then offer you a service that they have that costs money.
You spoke about the credit report versus the credit score. And I think we all know now that it's important to get a yearly credit report. Right. And there are a significant number of people who find that the credit report is inaccurate.
Yeah.
What's the process for that?
So to understand what a credit report is real quick. It's just where whenever you borrow money, then you make payments, or if you don't make payments, either way, the company that you borrow the money from then reports the information to a credit agency, credit bureau. TransUnion, Equifax, Experian are the three major ones. And so, and not everyone reports to all three. That's why you can have some variations or differences. But essentially, it's sort of an industry that got together and said, if I lend you money and you don't pay me back, you'll just go borrow from somebody else and keep doing it. So they kind of got together and said, we'll all share the information with each other so we know whether Bill Pratt, for example, if he goes over to Bank A and doesn't pay it back, Bank B will know that. And that's kind of what started this whole credit reporting thing. So that's the concept of the credit report. It kind of just lists the history. Oh, Bill borrowed money over here and money over there, and he's been making payments or hasn't, and so forth. So that kind of gives you an idea of what it's all about. And that's why it's important, because they can say whether or not you tend to make your payments or not. And so what happens is then if somebody messes up, like say someone keys the wrong digit and says you missed a payment, or that instead of saying you have a $10,000 credit card, it says you have a $30,000 credit card. Well, that could affect your score because the stuff is not accurate. So then what you have to do is you want to contact the creditor, the person whose information is incorrect, because they might fix it right away. And then if that doesn't work, or if you're in a hurry, contact the creditor and then also contact the credit bureau. And those are really the two main ways to do it. And then you dispute, you can go to each of the credit bureau's websites. They have a form you can fill out to do a dispute. And then they have a certain amount of time, I think it's 60 or 90 days, that they either have to resolve the dispute or they have to assume that you're correct. So, for example, say it said you missed a payment, you did not, especially if you have the documentation, you can send that to your creditor and they'll send the information in and they'll get it fixed. So it's a simple process, but the problem is the proof of burden is on you as the consumer.
11:36 here on the Wake Up Call, talking about personal finance with Piedmont Virginia Community College Professor Bill Pratt.
Today's programming on WNRN is supported by
Lexington Rockbridge Area Tourism, honoring the military capability, personal character, and faith of Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson with a Lee Jackson Day Symposium, January 16th, and a wreath-laying and military salute, parade, memorial service, luncheon, and gala ball on January 17th. More at lexingtonvirginia.com.
The American Shakespeare Center in downtown Stanton. Opening soon at the world's only recreation of Shakespeare's Blackfriars Playhouse, it's The Taming of the Shrew, The Rover, The White Devil, and Every Man in His Humor. For tickets and full schedule, it's AmericanShakespearCenter.com.
McGrady's Irish Pub on Grady Avenue, a veteran-owned sports pub under new ownership and management. McGrady's new menu holds a variety of loaded baked potatoes and Blarney Stone steaks. McGrady's supports local charities, hosts trivia on Tuesdays and ladies' night on Wednesdays, and is dedicated to getting everyone a safe ride home. McGrady'sIrishPub.com.
Hello, I'm Beryl Sola, Chair of the Art Department from Piedmont Virginia Community College. Whether you're unemployed or looking for a career change or want to take an art class, Piedmont Virginia Community College offers more than 40 programs developing professional skills for a new career. There are programs in which you can earn your degree in just a few semesters. Spring classes begin Monday, January 12th. You can register online at pvcc.edu/findyourfuture. I'm Beryl Sola, making a community connection on WNRN.
Make your community connection with WNRN. Email connection at WNRN.org with your nonprofit event or organization's information. Independent Music Radio, WNRN.
This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN, brought to you by the Markets of Tiger Fuel. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And thank you for being with us here on the first Sunday in 2015, along with Professor Bill Pratt, author of How to Keep Your Kid from Moving Back Home After College. Bill, that title, chuckle every time, because it's more important now than it was 10 years ago. What is the cost of education has skyrocketed. I think that's apparent to anyone who has any interest in college, university life.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The prices have skyrocketed. The value, I mean, I hate to say it this way, the value has gone down in some instances. It doesn't mean that we should not be sending kids to college. That's not what I mean. What I'm talking about is the value, meaning you spend twice as much for an education today as you did, say, you know, I don't know the stats, but just say 10 years ago, but there aren't twice as many jobs, or the jobs don't pay twice as well. So why is the value seem to be going down? And you know, there's a big discussion. You could do a whole hour, obviously, just on college costs and so forth. But what matters is having the right plan in place going to college and saying, you know, how much is the student going to be borrowing over 4 years or so? And what type of career field are they going to get into? What's the expected starting salary going to be? And then from there, you know, are we going to a realistic school that where the price kind of matches the starting salary? So we're not borrowing so much that even employed, they can't afford to live on their own.
Well, how do you keep your kids from moving back home?
Well, quite simply, yeah, just having the right plan to in place and understanding why they're going to college to begin with. You know, if your goal is to go to college in order to come out and have a great paying job, then what job are you going for? You know, it used to be years ago, college was a place to go find yourself. And you just kind of wandered around campus. And a few years later, you found who you were as a person. It's frankly too expensive to find yourself now. So you have to either find yourself quicker, like the summer before you go off to college, or maybe you're not quite ready to go on to the four-year school right away. But have that plan in place to say, here's the job I want, here's the classes I need to take to get the job I want, and here's the employers that I want to go to afterwards. And if you have those in place, then you should be able to find a job after college and not have to move home.
I thought that's what the master's degree was for.
I always say the master's degree is the great reset button. It's when you get your undergrad degree and you get out there and get your first job and realize, I don't like this. Why did I pick this degree? Well, you can hit reset by going and getting your master's degree.
Thank you. I can prove that. But the cost of going to college now, not that it didn't require serious budgeting before, but now, whether it's the budgeting of whomever is going to pay to go to college, and for someone who's coming out of college with a notable debt. But let's talk about budgeting for a moment, because it's such a crucial factor in terms of daily life. We've talked about how to set money aside in the envelopes. We've talked about how to have two different accounts, possibly. You talked about your way of doing that. But what percentage of people actually create and follow a budget or make that attempt?
Let's go with 28%. I made that up, but most people make up their budget, so it works out well, I guess. One of the things about a budget is it does have to be realistic. And while I do a very simple budget system today, I got there by starting to do a technical budget. I started with, you know, line items and really looking at it. And the whole point of a budget is not restriction. The point of a budget is to make sure you're spending the money on the things that matter the most to you and not wasting them on things that you don't really care about. Because when we don't, what happens is we simply, you know, spend money on little things here and there because it's easy. And then when the big things come along in life we want, we don't have anything left over. And that's kind of depressing. And so the point of a budget is to give you control. It's sort of an empowering tool, if you will, using one of the, we'll call it another 2015 buzzword, right? But it empowers you to take control of your money and say, I don't want to waste my money on, you know, a Hulu subscription if you're not using it, that is. I would rather spend my money on, you know, making sure my child has to borrow less for college, for example, or something like that.
When you talk about budgeting, you talked about communication earlier. How does the budget work in a house where there are two adults?
Oh, it doesn't. No. the end. No.
Is your wife listening to this podcast, by the way?
I hope not. No, she is. Hi, hon. So to be honest with you, the way it works in a household with two adults is communication. You have to communicate. So I learned this early in marriage, where, you know, I was an econ major and I kind of had these goals in my mind. And I thought, oh, I know what we can do. We can do this. We can pay this off. We can have this much saved in no time. And I never thought about the fact that what if my wife didn't have the same goals, you know? And so I learned very quickly the hard way that communication is key in personal finance in the household. So it's important to sit down with your spouse and start communicating and saying, okay, I have this particular goal. I'd like to pay off, let's say, a $10,000 credit card this year. And it might be that your spouse brings up a couple good points like, well, we already promised Susie that she gets to go to Europe this year. And then, you know, and Johnny's going off to college this year. So why don't we just make our goal to pay down the credit card this year? And you might not have thought about that. So it's certainly important that both spouses communicate, because the minute that one sort of tells the other one, here's what we're doing, it can create resentment, and then that you start fighting each other on the expenses.
What about in situations, and I realize now we're sort of floating out of the personal finance and into the relationship therapy, but when there are two adults in the house but only one income, or two adults in the house with significantly different incomes?
And certainly that depends on the relationship. You know, every relationship is different. Some of it depends on whether you're a married couple or just simply commingling assets, that sort of thing. But, you know, one of the traditional ways to do it is to say whatever is ours is ours. So whether one makes, you know, 20% and the other makes the 80%, or you're both 50-50, the money is 50-50. Other couples do it a little bit different, where they might say, well, we have some common bills together, but then we might have different spending accounts, and maybe the person who brings home more money has a slightly higher spending account. That's a possibility as well. But the key there is communication, and it shouldn't be necessarily the day you get married, you agree how you're going to do it, and then that's it forever. You know, maybe at the very least each year, at the beginning of the year, now's a great time. Sit down together, look at your bills and your expenses, and say, well, you know what, let's renegotiate, if you will. Let's talk about how we want to split our money this year. Is it still 50-50? And understand that the person who takes care of the budget doesn't necessarily mean they control the money. Taking care of the budget is a chore, just like washing dishes is a chore. Doesn't mean they're the only ones that get to eat off the dishes, right? So it's just a chore. Maybe I would rather do laundry and she would rather do the budget, or, you know, some, I'd rather do neither, but you get the point. So it's just a matter of how you divide the chore amongst the two of you, but you have to agree and communicate on how you're going to split the funds.
Do you think that single adults with just the single income have a more challenging time in saving money, or an easier time in saving money than a family? I bring this up because there's been a conversation recently that I had about how, Rick, you have it easy because there's just, you know, just you. You can choose to live in a small house and you don't have any kids. And my reply was, yeah, but I don't have anybody to share the electric bill with, or, you know, or the payment for the house or anything like that. And so it seems as though it's whichever side you're on always seems,
yes,
you have more detailed.
Yes, the money's always greener on the other side, right? You're absolutely right. And each scenario presents its own challenge. If you're single, the only advantage you would have then would be you could get a roommate, and then you could split bills, but you don't have to share, if that makes sense. You can split without sharing, but you have a roommate, so there's a huge social cost. Then if you're single living on your own, like in your situation, you're absolutely right. Everything is double. You know, cable isn't, let's say if it's a $100 cable bill, it's $100 just for you, not sort of $50 each. So certainly those expenses are huge. And, you know, sometimes families do have a disadvantage in the sense that, well, we have all these expenses for the kids, but that's all, a lot of that's choice related as well. You know, you have to choose, you decide we need a big yard for the kids. I mean, there's plenty of people that don't have a big yard for their kids. So those are, I think, a lot of sort of choice related things. The one advantage of being single is that you don't have to compromise, you don't have to share. The big disadvantage then is you don't have that second opinion, maybe that person to help ground you, if you will.
Ah, grounding. I wonder if if there's anyone out there saying, ah, Rick, you could do some grounding, and I'm sure that I should say yes. 11:49 on the wake-up call, talking about personal finance with Professor Bill Pratt, a professor of business at PVCC, also vice president at the Money Professors. Bill, back to this article that we were sharing earlier. Reminders of what you're saving for, because you mentioned Susie going away to soccer camp, Johnny going away to college, while the husband mentioned, you know, getting rid of the $10,000 credit card camp. So talk about reminders of what you're saving for.
Sure. So sometimes, and everybody's different, right? I've heard of things called vision boards, and that always makes my eyes roll. I always think they're kind of silly, but, you know, not that's not for me, but it's for some people. But, you know, there's nothing wrong with the simplicity of simply saying, we're going to save up for a new car, right? So why not have a picture of the car, print it up, and put it on the refrigerator? And, you know, it's the same thing people do with dieting, for example. Let's say you're going on vacation. You print a picture of where you're going on vacation. You put it on the fridge. Every time you go to open the fridge to grab a snack, you see that and realize, no, I'm losing weight because I want to look good on my vacation. Or, you know, whatever. Same thing happens with money. When you know what you're saving for, what you're sacrificing for, it's easier. It's really hard to say, I'm going to spend less money. Because why? Why spend less money? I'm happy tomorrow, let's say, if I go spend money on something. But if I say, I'm going to spend less money on entertainment so that I have money for a car, now all of a sudden, you have an actual goal. So whether you write it down, you have a picture, you put it on your cell phone screen, whatever the case might be. And by the way, that also helps in a relationship. So you and your spouse agree together you're going to buy a new car this year. And it's a lot easier to sacrifice and say, we're not going to get those new shoes. I'm not going to get that new tackle box, whatever. Why? Well, because we agree we're saving for the car. So you want to have a goal and you want to be able to have that reminder in order to have a reason. Oh, this is why I'm doing this.
I didn't know your wife wanted a new tackle box.
Well, you didn't know I wanted new shoes.
Exactly. Many people refer to that as retail therapy.
Yes, and there's something to be said for retail therapy. It can be less expensive sometimes, I suppose. But certainly, yes, we go through retail therapy. There's a great commercial out that I saw, and it has to do with, I think it's a Weight Watchers. It's about dieting. And every time you turn around, there's food coming out of dispensers. Well, the same thing happens with money. We spend as a way to celebrate everything. You're happy, you have a great occasion, something good happens, what do? You spend money and you go celebrate. Something bad happens, you feel depressed, you spend money to make yourself feel better. You know, there's an occasion, a birthday, you spend money. There's a, you know, a holiday, you spend money. We spend money every time we turn around as a way to celebrate, the same as we do with eating. And so it's, we have to really try to control that in order to sort of make a change in our budget.
One of the other things I wanted to make sure we get to before the hour's over is spending versus investing. Because we're talking about going out and spending for your retail therapy is different from, I mean, you can be spending money while it's investing, can you not?
I mean, it depends on what you're doing. The thing is, if you're purchasing something, you're not really investing. If you hear the word investing, it's because it's coming from a salesperson. You know, you want to invest in a good refrigerator. You don't invest in a refrigerator. Now, you can make a smart purchase by getting a higher quality refrigerator that will last longer, but that's certainly not an investment. An investment is something that grows in value for your future. So, you know, such as a savings account, not a savings account, sorry, but like a stock account or something like that. 401k at work, those type of things. That's really investing. So it's kind of like the same as you spend $100 at Kohl's and they say you save $50. You're thinking, no, I spent $100, right? So it's sort of a play on words sometimes.
Again, Bill Pratt with us today. 11:54, just a few minutes left in our hour. Is there such a thing as good debt?
As a consumer, there can be, if you want to look at it. I mean, understand all debt is risky. Anytime you take on debt, you've added risk. So with that in mind, is there a difference between good debt and bad debt? Sure. Let me give you a quick example. Let's say you realize that you could save up money for the next 4 years and then go to college for free for 4 years. That means 8 years from now, you could get a really good paying job. Or what if you borrow the money for 4 years, go to college now, and then get a good paying job 4 years from now, in which case it'd be much easier to pay off that debt if you do it correctly. So that's an example right there of good debt. It's because you're leveraging the debt to increase your income and make your life better. So yes, for that reason, there is good debt. But as we've talked earlier, it does add risk. What happens if your job pays less? What happens if you don't like the job you have when you graduate? What happens if you want to backpack in Europe when you graduate? Sorry, but you don't have those options, because one of the things I always emphasize with students is debt takes away choices. Once you've committed future dollars, you don't have the choice what to do with those or what to do with those hours that you need to spend earning those dollars. You've already made that purchase.
We talked about anytime you talk about money, it seems like in modern times we need to be concerned about theft, credit card theft, identity theft. What are the money out of my pocket? What do I need to worry about? Because it seems like for the most part, as much as I don't want for credit card theft, identity theft is a different, slightly different issue.
Right.
For credit card theft, doesn't all that fall on the credit card company?
Yes, it really does. I mean, if you wonder why do I care so much that a credit card gets stolen, it's really the hassle. You know, it's time that you have to spend. You have to call the credit card company. You have to get a new credit card issued to you. Obviously, if you never report it, eventually it could fall on you, but they usually catch it pretty quickly anyway. But it's really more of the hassle, the frustration, plus, you know, what if you have some automatic payments on that particular credit card, like a gym membership? Suddenly that credit card is no longer valid, so the gym membership isn't getting charged, and they're mad at you, but you don't pay attention because it's been automated for so long. So it's really more of a hassle for you. If it's a debit card, on the other hand, you know, some of those dollars come directly out of your checking account immediately. Now, will you get reimbursed? Yes. Will it take a few weeks? Yes. In the meantime, could you literally not be able to make payments? Sure. So that's certainly the bigger risk is on a debit card there.
I know some folks who keep, I don't know what significant qualifies that, significantly large, but, you know, a noticeable amount in their checking account for use of the debit card. Should that change, and where the money is kept in a savings account and is regularly transferred over? How do you, what are the steps to reduce the loss of a large chunk of money out of your checking account when using regularly for every payment that you have with your ATM card?
Well, so I like to keep money as simple as possible. I think that dealing with money is actually quite easy once we get it set up. So it's a little bit of upfront work. So for example, make sure at your bank that you have some type of text alert that says any purchase over a certain amount or any multiple purchases combined over a certain amount, and you get text alerts. So let's say you had a significant amount. Let's just say someone with a lot of money had, say, $10,000 sitting in a checking account, right? And all of a sudden, you don't want that $10,000 to get drained. So what you would do is you would set up an alert, and maybe after about $500 gets spent, you get a text and you're saying, wait, I haven't been spending any money. So you can immediately put a stop to it. So certainly, everyone's situation is different. I don't like the idea of having to keep constantly transferring money from savings. You can do that if that's what you want to do. I like to keep it simple. So just get a text alert. Let the bank tell you you're spending money, and if you're not, put a stop to it immediately.
So that the stories about, oh, if someone steals your credit card, your debit card information, they can drain all your money and you have $0 left. Not true anymore?
Well, it can happen, but it doesn't have to. And those are sort of, you know, as a responsible consumer, you want to protect yourself by setting up that text alert. You know, almost every bank and credit union has the capability to either put a cap on how much you're spending, or at the very least, like I said, let you know when it happens. And we all, I mean, whether we like to admit it or not, we all have our cell phones on us constantly. And so we would immediately know what's going on.
All right, about 60 seconds left. An important personal finance tip that we just haven't gotten to today.
Sure. Something that my wife and I were just talking about today, you know, set up some emergency contact information. In other words, contingency planning. You know, what happens when your water pump goes out? What happens when your well pump goes out? What happens when, you know, the air conditioning unit outside breaks down? Do you have an emergency fund set aside to help pay for some of that stuff? And do you already have a list of people you need to call when any of these things around your house or with your car and so forth break down or happen? That way you're not, you know, in the midst of the emergency, you're not stressed about tracking down phone numbers and so forth. So have the money, have the contact information, and just know if something happens, just go about your business and rebuild your emergency fund afterwards.
Thank you so much, Professor Bill Pratt from Piedmont Virginia Community College. You can find him online at Vice President of the Money Professors. That's moneyprofessors.com. You can also go on to Amazon under Pratt, P-R-A-T-T. How to Keep Your Kids from Moving Back Home After College and The Graduate's Guide to Life and Money. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Rick. Happy New Year.
And Happy New Year to you. Next week on The Wake Up Call, we'll be talking about the Affordable Care Act with Carolyn Engelhardt, professor at University of Virginia. Les Temps Perdue, coming up next.
This has been your Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on WNRN. The Wake Up Call is supported by the markets of Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at wakeupcall@wnrn.org. The Wake Up Call is produced by Brandon Wong
and Max Cecilia Struther.
Tune in next Sunday morning at 11 for The Wake Up Call, only on WNRN.